Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, the language of our clothing. We'll spend this hour with Shahida Bari of the London College of Fashion, talking about the choices we get to make about what we wear and how our choices can shape the way we move through the world. While clothes don't always receive serious attention from scholars and historians, Bari reminds us how much our body coverings communicate to others almost instantly about who we are, what we have, where we're going, and how we feel. Our conversation starts after a short break. And changes that have come along with the COVID-19 pandemic, people have been talking a lot about what they're wearing. Folks who normally show up to work in dress clothes can't quite get over the strangeness of remote meetings conducted in yoga pants or pajama bottoms. Work from home attire may indeed be more comfortable than standard office gear, but tell the truth, even if nobody can see you, do you ever feel somehow less together than when you're dressed up? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. In addition to protecting our bodies from the elements, clothing is also a very powerful communication device. Before we say a word, our apparel can telegraph where we come from, how we feel, and what we intend to do. And that's true whether you're a bona fide fashionista or you can barely pull an outfit together. Shahida Bari joins us to talk about the meaning of our style choices. She's professor of fashion cultures and histories at London College of Fashion and author of a new book called Dressed, A Philosophy of Clothes. Shahida, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me. I'm so pleased to be here.
You make a strong critique here of the idea that clothes are somehow a frivolous thing to care about. You note that caring about clothes also means caring about the people who make them and the people who wear them. How does clothing connect us to other people?
I think that the book begins from a position of anxiety. I wrote it because I did care about clothes, and it struck me, I'm an academic, it struck me that many people around me seem to think that it was an act of vanity to be interested in how you present yourself, or a form of narcissism, and that this was a shortcoming in some way. Whereas for me, it seemed to me what not just one of the ways we express ourselves, but one of the ways in which we're susceptible to each other. Well, whenever you leave your house, whenever we will be able to leave our homes, I hope, you know, we brush against people, a velvet jacket sleeve against, you know, a jersey collar, you know, where we're constantly in contact with each other. And the beginning of the book, I talk about my eye being caught by a girl in a jade skirt climbing the escalator to get into the subway in London. And I feel like people think that clothes don't matter, that they're frivolous and narcissistic, but they're one of the ways in which we're responsive to each other. And I really care about that.
You say if we love language, we might find that we love clothes as well. What do the two have in common?
I think that... I write that if you love language, you might also love clothes. And I think there's something similar between the two, that often when we speak, we are trying to find ways to articulate something precisely exact, a kind of exactitude about our experience, about our day, about what we feel and think. And clothes are that too for some of us. Some of us are trying to express really precisely something very specific about ourselves, about the ways that we're alert to life or to some complexity. But the other side of language too is that we evade in language. I think that's really interesting, that sometimes we speak in order to conceal ourselves. And I'm as much interested in the idea that our clothes are disguises, that we're hiding in our clothes in broad daylight as much as we are expressing ourselves.
Why are we so often drawn to dress like the people around us?
I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know if I agreed with it. There are two ways I think about it. In one way, I write about disguise and costume and how peculiar it is when you think about it that we could dress up as another person, as you do. I know in America, Halloween is a much bigger affair than it is in the UK, but we make an effort to dress up too. But it's so strange to me that we could pretend to be somebody else. We could imitate, you know, a character in a horror movie or something, or dress up as a joke as one of our family members. The idea idea that we could imitate somebody else is really peculiar to me, because when you can imitate someone, it almost questions the uniqueness of your own personhood, and I find that really interesting. But the other angle on costume or the idea that we dress like other people is that I think we're living through a really interesting historical moment where human beings have never looked more different. And if you think about it, you know, our ancestors had far fewer options in terms of what they could wear. There were greater restrictions according to where you live in the world. There are still some restrictions, but by and large, more and more of us are able to dress wildly and freely or perfectly ordinarily. But there is such diversity in the ways that we present ourselves. So I sort of think that's a kind of amazing aspect of our modern world.
Reading this book made me think about the fact that despite what we think about ourselves, there is nobody who doesn't sometimes use clothes to signify things, right? Nobody would wear the same thing to a wedding that they would wear to weed the garden, even if they say they don't care that much about clothes.
Absolutely. I mean, I wrote the book for lots of women like me who think about clothes and care about clothes, lots of gay men who love clothes. And I also wrote for people who don't care about clothes, and almost more intentionally for that crowd, precisely because I wanted them to remember the feeling of their clothes again, to think about the wonder of clothes, but also the tragedy of our clothes. One of the things I say in the book is that we walk through the world quite thoughtlessly. If you think about our shoes, for instance, whenever we're allowed to walk through the world again and put on our shoes, that feels like a very remote memory at the moment. But when we do, you know, we're quite disrespectful of our shoes. In my house, we pile them up in our porch, and when you peel off your trainers, you use one foot to crush the back of the heel and pull it off, and our shoes and boots walk through all sorts of detritus and debris. But also our shoes are the way that we move through the world, and they are feats of engineering that allow us to accomplish all sorts of things. And it strikes me that we don't often think about them, and perhaps we should. And as you said at the beginning of our conversation, I think that it's really important to care about our clothes, if only that we start to care about the people who make them.
Shoes are ostensibly worn to protect our feet from the elements, but women in particular know they're a lot more than that. They can change the way we move. As you say, they can hobble us or they can enable us.
Yeah, I don't know what shoes you're wearing, Chris, or if you are wearing shoes at all, but I've injured my ankle, sadly, so I'm in the ugliest orthopedic boot you've ever seen. It's this grey plastic, I keep calling it a sexy RoboCop look, and it's awful because I'm very tiny. I'm barely 5 foot, and I love wearing big heels, big wedge heels that give me maybe 3 inches more. And when I wear heels, something happens to my spine, and it cants the axis of my body, and I know that it levels. I'll never be as tall as most other people, but it levels me in some way that allows me to adjust my focal length between the person I'm standing in front of. And it tells me that I'm in work mode, or I'm in some kind of presentational mode. And I love that. And I cherish wearing shoes, but I know the shoes that I love most of all were the running spikes I wore when I was 12, and I was a child athlete. And I remember that memory of a teacher spotting that I was quite gifted and putting a pair of running spikes on my shoes and lacing them. And the first time that I ran in them, that feeling of just, you know, endless possibility, like I was springing into the air. And I feel that with a particular pain right now because I've injured my foot and I might not ever run like that again. But, you know, shoes are full of really powerful memories about what our bodies can do.
It's interesting for me. I'm still going into the office every day, but we are on an absolute skeleton crew here, and everybody that I interview is in a remote location, so they won't see how casually I'm dressed. So I've been wearing sneakers every day, and I'm wondering why I've been wearing dress shoes all this time. As much as I like the way they look, why do we ever choose shoes that hurt us?
I think that there is a great historical precedent for women, particularly wearing shoes that immobilize them. And I ask that question, why is it not just shoes, but why is the history of fashion, why has the history of fashion for so long been unconducive to the well-being of women? Not only in what we wear, the shoes that hobble us or the bra strap that digs, you know, the corsets that contract your ribs and the panniers that cut into your waist. waste. But also the women who make clothes. For the longest part of this history of clothes making, women have been borne the brunt of making clothes in the most unutterable conditions. And I wonder, why is clothes making and clothes wearing unconducive to the well-being of women? And what can we do about it? I do think it's cultural, and I think it can change. I mean, that's why I'm at the London College of Fashion. I'm interested in talking to this new generation of makers who are thinking about freedom, the question of freedom and equality when they're thinking about how to make clothes. And that seems to me exactly what our clothes could be about.
You note that ballet pointe shoes are a complete deception, right? They look so delicate. They're usually made of like satin and they have ribbons. Inside those shoes is an unyielding block of wood and just, as I understand it, just a little bit of padding.
Yeah. Did you wear block shoes ever? Did you wear, did you dance, Chris?
I did not, and the world is glad that I didn't, but I always wanted to.
Yeah, well, I did a little and it was painful, but I wrote that because I always think there's this strange irony about the delicacy of the ballerina and their pliancy, this body that yields. Often in classical ballet, certainly the woman's part is yielding and pliant, and the pointe shoe is solid inside, and it's very addictive, this, but you can find videos of ballerinas preparing their pointe shoes on YouTube, and it takes hours. They get through shoes very rapidly. It can be a matter of weeks for working ballerinas, you know, 2 weeks a week, and they have to prepare their shoes meticulously. They're often made bespoke by their particular ballet shoe maker, and then they are scored on the sole. They are beaten and cracked and weathered, and so that they can precisely allow the traction that's required in order to enable the kind of performance, the enormous athletic performance that ballet is. And it struck me as that's what's happening backstage, and it's so fascinating and ironic, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting that in ballet, the athleticism is supposed to be under the surface, whereas in a lot of sports, the shoes really tell us that they're very technical looking and they really tell us that something special is happening here.
Yeah, I know people often ask me what was my favorite garment when I was writing this book, and I think they expect me to describe a beautiful Alexander McQueen dress. But what I always talk about is a pair of, we call them Nikes here, but Nike, right? Nike Magista training shoes, and they're the shoes that were worn by Cristiano Ronaldo at a World Cup several years ago. And they're the ugliest shoes you've ever seen. They're a soccer boot, basically, and they are luminous yellow with this kind of reptilian skin, but they are Flyknit, so they are extremely light, and they have this remarkable thing which is called it's sort of called an integrated sock liner, if you can imagine such a thing. So you don't need to wear a sock. The shoe extends into a sock, and so there's this seamless line between you, the football player, your brain, your body, your foot, and the sock, the boot, and then the ball. All of these things are connected in this kind of magnificently dynamic way, and it's they're extremely responsive, and they are a feat of engineering, technology, science, and a strange beauty, I think, too.
To have no shoes is to convey poverty in a lot of cultures. Someone who doesn't have shoes is assumed to be in a really humbled position.
Yeah, I start the book by talking about feet, about how lowly feet are, that our feet get bunions and blister, and we're often quite disgusted by feet. But actually, our feet are the most basic building block of our being human, and that's why we're so delighted when children take their first steps. And I think there is something about the way our shoes are connected to our sense of self-possession and civilization, if we want to put it like that, that in our moments of greatest duress, we might not have time to grab our shoes. When the earthquake hits, when something is happening, you just have to grab your things and run, and there may not be time for shoes, and that says something, I think.
My guest is Shahida Bari. She's professor of fashion cultures and histories at the London College of Fashion and author of Dressed, A Philosophy of Clothes. Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Shahida Bari. She is professor of fashion cultures and histories at London College of Fashion and author of a new book called Dressed, A Philosophy of Clothes. This book made me think a lot about the ways that clothing conveys permission. I went to a Catholic girls' school for high school. We all wore the same thing, and you sort of knew who belonged because we were all dressed alike. Karl Marx became obsessed with the way that clothes let him enter certain spaces and not others.
Yeah, he famously was, I don't know if this is famous, but he was terrible with money, ironically, Marx himself, and he was often broke. And at one point he had to pawn his dress coat. And he did that in order to secure money to feed his family. But then he found that since he wasn't wearing his dress coat, he couldn't gain access to the British Museum, where the British Library was, where he needed to work. And so he had to go back and get his coat. And I talk about that moment because, of course, Marx writes about value and the financial value of an object, the labor value, the value of the people and the resources that are taken into making the object, and then the surplus value, you know, how much we charge for an object, who profits from it. And that's the basis, of course, of his theories of communism. And I think that's really interesting that he thinks about a coat. He also talks about a dressmaker in Capital. He talks about a dressmaker called Marianne Walkley, who died of overwork. I think she'd worked for something like 27 hours straight for an exclusive dressmaker. And she became a cause célèbre in Britain and elsewhere about the nature of garment workers and women who were working in extraordinary lengths and conditions. So I think he's sort of peculiarly interested in clothes.
Dresses play a kind of magic role in some fairy tales. You know, one thinks about Cinderella, who is recognizable as special only when she's given this marvelous gown to wear to the ball. What gives dresses their particular power?
I'm still trying to get to the bottom of that, Chris. I think about it a lot. In the Cinderella story, I think about what it means in that story for her to be finally recognized as the person she is and to be valued by someone when she wears a beautiful dress and when the shoe fits. And what that means, does it mean that the shoe and the dress make her, that give her that self-worth? And would the prince have loved her anyway? It's never very clear. And I think there can be very unsympathetic readings of the story. But the way I take that Cinderella story is that it articulates our fantasies about dress. I think we have an idea that our dresses could enable magical things, that the world will yield to us, we'll get the job that we want, or we'll find the partner that we long for. You know, magical things will happen to us. The world will lend itself to our whim if only we're wearing the right outfit. And I know that's a fantasy. I know that from my own life. And I wanted to try and think about how damaging that fantasy can be in some ways.
Do we wear dresses for ourselves or for other people?
Well, I don't know. I think it must change every day, doesn't it? I sometimes think that at the moment, my husband has been wearing, perhaps a bit like you, he's been wearing very casual clothes, and he's been wearing a tracksuit. Do you call it a sweatsuit?
Uh-huh. Or a tracksuit, yeah.
A sweatsuit, a tracksuit. And it's, I have to say, Chris, it's the ugliest thing I've ever seen. And he's been wearing it for like 2 weeks straight in this lockdown. And it's causing me great distress. And I said to him, I wish you would dress something else just as a kind of act of care for me. Because I want him to dress for me so that he's the only other person I'm seeing during this quarantine, really. But I wonder sometimes. I think there is a fantasy that women dress for male attention. And I'm not sure that's true. I certainly know that when I'm never interested in the way I dress. I'm much more interested in the way other people dress. But when people notice what I dress, I love the compliments of other women. I love being able to recognize not just their knowledge, because sometimes when somebody's dressed really well, it's about the things that they know about their body and the form that they have and how they've learned the various contours and planes of their body and the color that suits them. I love all of that. But it's also the way that they're alert to life sometimes, somebody's just wearing a pin or as a certain color tie, and you see it on a grizzly gray day, which happens a lot in London, and your entire day feels different because somehow that person is responding to something. And I love that. I feel like that's a gift to me to see somebody do that.
The dress uniform for men, at least in Western cultures, is the suit. What's fascinating to me is that we associate them with a certain kind of masculinity, but they're not particularly revealing of masculine figures. They give every wearer essentially the same silhouette and have for 150 years.
Yeah, I think that's right, that is the power of the suit, is a certain kind of anonymity, that it feels implacable. It feels the lines of the suit, although they can be cut in remarkable ways and dynamic ways, and they can come in all sorts of colors and textures now. The lines of the suit were designed to conceal the body, and they were designed as uniforms. In fact, it's Charles II who issues an edict in the UK, certainly, outlining what he thinks should be the uniform for men of a certain class. And it's because he's fed up of what he takes to be a kind of Catholic excess and a kind of effeminacy and luxury and a sumptuousness that he wants to restrain. So he issues this edict for the suit, and the famous diarist Samuel Pepys, he notes down that there's been this law instituted, or this regulation about men wearing these two-part outfit, which is the suit. And the history of the suit is about regularity and uniformity, and that has become powerful. And I think that's such a peculiar thing.
What happens when a woman puts on a suit?
Yeah, I'm puzzling over this all the time, and I write about different famous women who wear suits. I write about Annie Hall in that boxy oversized suit. I write about Marlene Dietrich looking, in that nipped in tuxedo, and how she's imitating a kind of inimitable, beautiful kind of masculinity, and she's doing something to it. My favorite suit wearer of all is Janelle Monáe, because that the tuxedo is almost her uniform of choice. And I write about the music video to Make Me Feel from a few years ago, and how she wears suits that are jazzed up with sequins and embellished lapels and dynamic waists. And I wonder what she's doing there, whether it's a kind of parody of masculinity, whether it's a kind of emulation of masculinity, or whether it's a kind of mocking of it, to be able to say anybody can wear these things, anybody can assume the powers that are granted by the suit, and all of us can perform it differently. We can perform it with charm and flair, which is what I think she always does.
Why do you think the suit was so important to Charlie Chaplin when he was trying to create a character like the Little Tramp?
He thinks really carefully about his costume for that character. He raids a costume cupboard basically, and finds a hat that doesn't fit, and a suit that's scuffed at the elbows, and shoes that are slightly oversized. And he wants to present somebody who is at odds with their society, someone who wants to be at evens with their society, who wants to fit in, but who's never going to quite sit right. And that those are always the characters that concern him: the immigrant, the penniless, the forlorn. He's thinking about the angles at which they are to society, and they're longing to be part of what feels like an exclusive society. And there's a kind of I find them very moving, those suits. They sort of break my heart, as well as make me howl with laughter every time the trousers fall down and he has to hoist it up with his walking stick.
All right, I want to go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Matt is calling us from Irving, Texas. Hi, Matt.
Hey, Chris. Great conversation. Really enjoy it.
Thanks.
Just a quick story and then a question. So, whenever I used to go to be involved in the community and function, I was always wear a suit, and no matter what, everybody thought I was a lawyer. They either thought I was a lawyer or a banker, and I constantly had to say, "Oh no, I do this," So. I guess for me, clothes sometimes make the man. My question is, I have a couple of friends who love shoes, and even some who are male, and they will buy shoes and they will just sit in their closet it's almost as if they're decorating their closet and they'll never wear them. And so I wanted to ask, what's the psychology behind that? Why do people buy shoes that they may never wear?
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'm really interested in wearing the suit in a court of law, because I think also the suit can betray vulnerability. I write very sadly, I think, sometimes thinking about it, that the moments when the suit fails, when an American president is shot in the back of a limousine, when the World Trade Center collapse and you see all those workers leaving with their dusty collars and their terrified looks. You know, the suit has an idea of strength, but sometimes that strength is revealed as just a facade, and that we're all vulnerable in our suits in the end. And I think that that's a truth about the suit. But the thing about buying clothes and shoes that we will never wear, I am absolutely guilty of that. And I've thought hard about it, and I'm still baffled by it. But I think something is, it's about longing for a certain kind of life or a certain kind of ambition. And sometimes I've bought things that I think I might grow into, or I might be thin enough, or, you know, something might happen that I might be able to wear. And they're kind of aspirant. But there are other things that I've bought almost knowing that I will never wear them, because they are so beautiful in themselves. And they articulate something about the world or the person I want to be. And even though I might never be that person in that world, I somehow need to possess it. And I think about clothes as art objects sometimes, as artifacts. Sometimes they can be so beautiful that they belong to us, even though we might never be able to wear them. It is a strange phenomenon, but I think it's true that many of us buy things and we will never wear them. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't buy them.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. As you note in the book, Shahida, humans are the only animals that are aware of our own nakedness. We are the only ones that wear clothing of our own volition. We're going to leave aside the dogs that get dressed by their owners. Our sense of being naked drives us to cover ourselves, and we often cover ourselves with things taken from animals or things that resemble animals. What is that about?
Yeah, I should say the book is organized by garment. There's a chapter about dresses and a chapter about shoes. And then I have a section on furs, feathers, and animal skins in general. And I wanted to think about the remarkable thing that we are the only creatures who dress. And I talk about a philosopher called Jacques Derrida, the French philosopher, who writes a book about animal life. And he recalls this moment where he is getting undressed in front of his cat. And he laughs because he feels embarrassed at being naked in front of his cat. And his cat is naked, of course. And it is a ridiculous moment. But he says, you know, there is something astonishing about the fact that we dress. There are a few things that we do that other creatures don't do. And we could talk about what those things are, you know, maybe grieving the dead, maybe writing in the way that we do. But dressing is one of those things that we do. And he says, what is it about us? What is it that we're doing? Is it that we're concealing ourselves because we're ashamed? Or is it something else? But whatever it is, it's something that makes us exceptional. And I'm really interested in that idea that we might be exceptional, because I think maybe we're not. But one of the things that we do when we wear the skins of other animals is to say that we're exceptional, because we think that we can master animals and we can use their leathers and their hides and their furs to dress our bodies. It's an act of mastery and a really troubling one in many ways, too.
I think a lot of people no longer think it's acceptable to wear natural fur that's actually taken from an animal. But historically, you discover that it's really been, fur has been a symbol of a kind of sexuality. Why is that?
Well, I mean, there's some Freudian arguments about fur being resonant of pubic hair and other things. I don't know how seriously you want to take that. But I think it is about desire. I talk about Red Riding Hood. Red Riding Hood's story is a kind of pubescent fantasy of sex. That's the psychoanalytical theory of it, which sounds wild when you say it like that. But in that moment when Red Riding Hood is looking into the jaws of the wolf who is pretending to be her grandmother, she is looking inside the body of a man, and she is a woman or about to become a woman who has very little experience of the world, but maybe is thinking about what it might mean to be inside the body of another creature. It's a kind of sexual experimentation, that story, in the psychoanalytical account of it. And I think there is something of that animals are a representation of a kind of carnality or wild desire. Certainly in Greek and Roman myths, you know, often sex is described between the gods and mortals as a kind of animal act. You know, when Europa is raped by Zeus, he turns into a bull. I talk about Leda being raped by the swan. There is a kind of relationship between animality and sex, and our wearing of animal skins, I think, sometimes has that tacit memory. And I think that particularly because women more often wear animal skins, it seems to me. At least they wear textures that solicit touch, you know, the furs that you want to stroke, or the angora that you want to caress. And why is it that women's bodies seem to solicit touch so much more than men? I'm really interested in trying to understand why that might be.
When you give us that sexual metaphor for the story of Little Red Riding Hood, we also have to ask, is she tricked by the wolf, or does the wolf give her plausible deniability?
I don't know. I don't know if any of us will ever be able to get to the bottom of that story. But I think that it isn't an innocent story. I don't think fairy stories are ever really innocent. I think one of the more interesting stories for me in that section about animal skins is one from the philosopher Walter Benjamin, who talks about leather gloves. And he's looking at a pair of leather gloves. He's a German philosopher in the beginning, early decades of the 20th century. And he is German Jewish, and it's at a moment where he's being persecuted, of course, by the Nazis. And he's looking at these leather gloves, and he sees in them, he says, a kind of a horror that stirs deep within, an obscure awareness that in him lies something akin to the animal. And I think we see that in animal skins, that we lay them next to our skin and we realize we are animals too.
Shahid Abari is my guest. Her book is Dressed, A Philosophy of Clothes. We'll be right back. Chris Boyd speaking this hour with Professor of Fashion Cultures and Histories at the London College of Fashion, Shahid Abari. Her book is called Dressed, A Philosophy of Clothes. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org. We heard from Herman, who wanted to know about clothes bought off the rack, which, you know, are what most of us can afford. Herman wants to know, is there some power conveyed in the fact that those off-the-rack clothes are designed to fit some bodies and not others?
Yeah, that's such a good question. I think there's a certain there's almost a kind of indignity sometimes in the garments that we buy off the rail, off the rack, that as though our bodies are unique and they have, you know, they have planes and curves and proportions that are unique to us. And the idea that we could meet a standard size 8, 10, 12, or a shoe size, whatever it is, it can feel like an insult to our uniqueness. But I think it is absolutely the experience for many people, that there is something really alienating by realizing that the world does not cater to your particular form, as though you do not exist. And it's one of the great challenges for design students at the moment, where I teach at London College of Fashion, to be able to think of the fashion as a system that could be more inclusive and can think about different kinds of bodies and lend itself to that.
Is it, you know, the assumption is that the most revered designers have pushed back against this idea that they ought to design for different kinds of bodies. Is that outdated now? Are there people who are designing high fashion that want to make clothing possible for people with very different kinds of bodies?
I think that's a really good question, and it's really hard to answer because so much of the fashion industry is about optics. It's about the way that it presents itself. And there is a kind of credibility that comes with having a social justice agenda that imagines a more inclusive kind of fashion, just as there is a kind of cachet that comes with being interested in sustainability and ecologically friendly forms of fashion. And it's not clear whether brands are really invested in them. Very often, when they do engage in more diverse models, models of different color, models of different body shapes and body forms, models with disabilities, when we start to think about menswear and women's wear ranges, not just being for men or for women, thinking about different forms of gender identity, fashion is a system that's always been very limited and narrow. And sometimes it dallies, it toys with diversity and sustainability as though it were a kind of fashion, as though it were a trend. And it's hard to see how fashion as a system could bring about really long-term changes, but that's what it needs to do, because everybody dresses and clothes are such a central part of our culture and our identity that we have to start thinking about dress as something for everybody.
It's ironic that the rules of dress actually permit more variation in some ways for women, at least in the modern world, than they do for men. Women can wear trousers and they can wear dresses and everything in between. A man who chooses to wear something that looks like a skirt will be seen as a real outlier, even though there's no particular reason why that shouldn't happen.
Yeah, I mean, careful what you say, Chris, because I'm married to a Scotsman and you know
okay.
what Scotsman I like. But no, I think that's true. I think that's true that there's, I mean, I think it's strange. It's difficult for women because in one way, I think that we are subject to much greater scrutiny. I think that is absolutely the case, that we live in cultures that objectify women and women are assessed on their appearance, on their body shape. And I think all women know that experience of leaving the house and just stopping at the door for a moment to check that their skirt is long enough and that their top is not too low cut, and on the most terrible days where you think, I'm going to come home late, am I going to be able to run in these heels if I need to? And there are always these questions, I think, for women that gives us a certain vigilance. We're thinking about whether we're going to be safe in what we wear and whether we'll be judged. By the same token, you're absolutely right that there's a greater range of garments available to us, colours, fabrics, cuts, designs. There is a kind of largesse that's also available to us. And we're caught between those two places of constraint and surveillance and freedom and flair.
All right, I want to go back to the phones. Our number is 800-933-5372. Jared is on the line in Plano, Texas. Hi, Jared.
Hi there. So I wanted to ask about the use of our different clothing and our own different styles as a form of code switching between the different aspects and different friend groups in our life. About, of course, our party clothes are our party clothes and our work clothes are our work clothes. But that code switching can make us be perceived differently, but could also have us act differently so that potentially we are more productive when we put on our work clothes and probably more fun when we wear our party clothes. So,
thanks for calling. What do you think, Shahida?
That's such a brilliant question, Jared. I've been thinking really hard about that lately because obviously many of us are working from home now. Lots of us are working from home, and the line between our home selves and our office selves has so often been demarcated by the different things that we wear. I know when I get home from work, I want to kick off my shoes and put on my most shapeless, most comfortable loungewear, and then I know I'm home. That's the only time I really feel like I've unwound. Now we're working from home, that line is more blurred. And I've had lots of Zoom meetings or online video conferencing with colleagues where all of a sudden I'm getting a glimpse into their home lives and they're wearing their favorite sports jersey or a frayed cardigan. And I'm finding it really moving and humanizing to see that other side of their lives, because right now all of us are finding it hard to juggle our work lives and our home lives and our families and our health. And we're all in this kind of state of muddle and difficulty. And it's moving and democratizing to see it. But I think it's right that I think there is a kind of work clothes that works upon us. So if you wear a tie or a collar to work, one of the things it will do is that it will stiffen your spine and straighten your neck. So it will make you stand or sit more erectly. And that will it will tell your body that you're in a particular mode, a mode of productivity maybe, and that it tells you you're at work, and it might trick you into doing work even. And similarly with uniforms, you know, they signal to other people, I'm at work and this is my role. I think about that now a lot when I think about health workers. My brother is a doctor working in a COVID ward at the moment, and he has very limited protective equipment. And I feel such tenderness for those health workers who are wearing their uniforms, and they're signaling to us, you know, the work that they do. And every time I see them, and I see grocery store workers in their uniforms, and I've never given them a second thought. And now I think, my God, the debt I owe to you in the uniforms that you're wearing, in the service that you're giving, so that we can live in the ways that we're trying to live through this pandemic.
Do you have any sense yet of what the arrival of cloth masks as a pretty ubiquitous accessory in Western societies for the first time will mean over time? Will we change so that, as in some Asian countries, these become something that is pretty common?
The face masks.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's hard to predict. I know that in the UK and perhaps in the States too, that there are lots of images on social media at the moment of health workers who've been wearing the masks for very long shifts, and their faces are striated with the mark of the ribbons and the bands, and I'm finding it almost impossible to look at those images, and lots of us are struggling over face masks. At the same time, I know when I go shopping, people are wearing all sorts of kind of impromptu ad hoc masks, you know, scarves and things. And I don't know what will happen in terms of masks. I'm slightly troubled that fashion designers are making masks at the moment. I know that it's a gesture of a kind of contribution, that's an effort by the fashion industry to try to contribute to what's happening at the moment. But it also seems like such a limited thing for us to do. But all I do know is that after this pandemic, I think that one of the things that we might realize is how indebted we are to people who wear certain kinds of clothes. And we might remember the comfort that our clothes give us. I know right now lots of us are wearing comfortable clothes, but there is a place for the self-comfort that comes of our clothes, as in, you know, when we're in a state of mental distress, sometimes it's our physical well-being that goes first. And taking care of yourself, bathing, washing, putting on your clothes, is an act of profound self-care.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. You include handbags in this book, and we should start by noting that men's clothes, like almost always, come with pockets. Women's clothes often do not. How did the habit of carrying a purse become ubiquitous for women?
So I think if you think about early societies, the context in which I work is largely European history, but how women don't have possessions. They don't have money. They have very little possessions. And so why would you need a bag? Why would you need a purse to have money when you have no money? Why would you need a place to store your keys when you have no property? And so it's part of the great insult of womanhood, isn't it, that we weren't allowed pockets because we own nothing. And I talk about that, actually, that right to own things. What the thing about the bag or pockets and purses is that they say you own things, and you're able to say, that is mine, therefore I am me. And there is a way in which our subjecthood or our personhood is instantiated by that act of owning stuff. What happens with women is that they have secret pockets under their dresses. They have sort of little purses that are tied to their waist. And there's a great deal of anxiety, a social anxiety, about what women are secreting or keeping in their purses. Because for a woman to have a personal private space is for her to have secrets. And that makes her a troubling figure. But of course, women have secrets. So that's why we have purses, and that's why we deserve pockets and big bags too.
And today, a handbag is considered a kind of deeply personal space. Almost no one, including people in one's own family, will go into a woman's purse without permission.
Yeah, I don't know what kind of bag you have, but I know I feel undressed unless I have something on my arm. My husband and I often get into rows where he never thinks of taking a bag to pick up the groceries. He can just stuff his things in his pockets, where I always take a bag because I'm thinking about the things that I will need in the day and what I will have to carry home. And I'm thinking ahead. I always say that I'm the kind of person that always has bags, and because I'm always packing a spare pair of tights or hose and tissues and allergy tablets and makeup and what have you. But I can never find the things that I want, even though I have so many bags. It's really infuriating. But I think that there is something about the ways that we're trying to prepare for the world. And I write about, you know, what it means to be a refugee, for instance, and to flee the places that you belong without your possessions, the few paltry belongings that you're able to take with you, and what it means to have bags that enable you to travel. The luxury of travel that is enabled to us is marked by the development of luggage, of suitcases, of carry cases that tells us suddenly human beings are portable and they can move places. But bags are a privilege too, it seems to me.
And it is a really, it's surprising what a violation it feels like to have one's bags searched in public, as in at the airport.
Yeah, I write about this. I mean, it feels violating for anybody, doesn't it? It feels that I talk about the pickpocket, the Robert Bresson film, which is this gorgeous black and white French film where a pickpocket is kind of, he's almost balletic in the surreptitious ways. He slides his hand into your bag and will steal something. But he's this really illicit figure who is committing this awful transgression in doing that. But it does seem to me that some of us are subject to greater violations than others. I know my father is Muslim and is visibly Muslim, and I've been with him at the airport before, and I know what happens in those cases, what the kind of suspicion that comes. What are you taking? And if I can see everything in your bag, if I can search your person, maybe I will have the measure of the person you are. But the thing is, we're so much more than the things that we can carry, it seems to me as well, that our bags are just a kind of visible space, a private space we want it to be, but a visible space. And there's so much more inside us too. And I think about the bag as a metaphor for interiority, this thing that makes us up, the human beings we are, the inside space in which we carry and hold and keep all sorts of things.
In the last 30 seconds, any sense of how our clothing will change in the coming decades?
I wrote this book because I love clothes and I want people to think about clothes, but I also wrote it because we're in the grip of an ecological disaster and fashion has a great deal to do with it. It is an enormous global industry and it's responsible for 10% of carbon emissions in the air, of more than 100 billion items of clothing. 20% of it will end up in landfill or incineration. It's a huge problem. And what I hope is that we'll start to care about our clothes so that we care about the people who make them, we'll care about the resources that we use in making them, and we'll understand the ways, the deep ways that we're connected to each other through our clothes. That's what I hope. I don't know. But I also think the technologies of our clothes will change. You know, I think it's becoming increasingly fluid, isn't it? What the rules are and what you might have to wear or can wear. And I can't wait to see what human beings look like in the next 100 years.
Shahida Bari is professor of fashion cultures and histories at London College of Fashion and author of Dressed, A Philosophy of Clothes. Shahida, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Oh, thank you.
You can follow us on Facebook and also on Twitter. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.